In episode 4 of Books and Beer, we discuss Alice Munro, her short stories, her themes, how a lot of people end up dead, that kind of stuff. Stay tuned. Hi, we're here for another episode of Books and Beer Podcast. This time, sans beer.
Yes, it's been a long weekend.
It has been a long weekend because we're in Chicago, and this weekend AWP was in town.
AWP is the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, and they have an annual conference, which is a huge gathering of writers and publishers and editors and literary agents, and they all get together and talk about writing for 3 days. And there's a huge book fair, which Greg and I both attended, and I attended some panels, but it was an all-day event for 3 straight days that just wrapped up yesterday, so I'm pretty tired.
And I only went to it for not even... I think I went for it for maybe 2 or 3 hours, and I was still pretty exhausted.
It was like an hour and a half.
Yeah. It wasn't that long, but it's still pretty exhausting because there's a bunch of energy around the conference.
And yeah, there's about 10,000 attendees. It was held at 2 different hotels downtown, and the book fair was 4 huge conference rooms filled with booths, and there were hundreds of exhibitors, and a lot of them were university presses, university MFA programs, and then a lot of literary magazines and independent or small vanity presses and publishing companies. And it was really, there was a lot of free swag and a lot of really reduced price books, and really very, very interesting, but kind of overwhelming. You couldn't really spend more than an hour or so down there before you started to feel like it was just too much and you had to go back up for air. But we came away with lots and lots of books and a few literary magazines and some tote bags and a t-shirt and all kinds of bookmarks and flyers and pamphlets, and it was very, very fun.
Yeah, and we went on, you went the book fair the first day or two, but I went on Saturday, which was the last day, so there was an air of desperation as they were trying to get rid of what they'd come to sell. So they were just, I think approached by several people, just almost cold called or whatever.
Yeah, trying to
sell me stuff and ask me
cut
if
down
I was
the
a writer.
Prices and sort of shove things into your hands. But it was a good day. And all 3 days there were a variety of panels and discussions and readings that I attended, and some of them were very, very good and very, very interesting, with some very well-regarded and well-known authors like Jane Smiley. And if we have time in a little bit, we may talk about one of the panels I attended, which I found very interesting, and Greg and I had an interesting discussion about following when I was telling him about it. But I guess tonight we're here to talk about Alice Munro, who is a bit of a unique author. I don't really think there's anybody else out there like her. I don't know if you got that impression when you read it. We read two of her books, one of which was an anthology of a lot of her earlier work, and the other book, Too Much Happiness, was her most recent release of short stories. And one of the things that's interesting about Alice is that she only writes short stories. She said in interviews that that's the only form that comes naturally to her, and she's never been inclined or tried to write a novel, never really wanted to. And I think that makes her an anomaly among writers, for whom short stories are usually something you start with and then you write a novel, because novels usually sell better and are much easier to get picked up. And but her short stories are, she's probably the most, if not definitely one of the most successful short story writers in literature today. She's Canadian, but she has a huge international audience, and she's been writing for decades now. She's a name that gets thrown around a lot for MFA type writers such as myself, as someone to stand up to, because her stories are just fantastic. And I'm curious to hear what you thought about her, having not read her before?
Well, I guess we could start, I guess, by discussing some of the specific stories, just sort of illustrate out, and then we can draw back a little, I guess.
Yeah, tell me which stories struck you. I know that when you finished the first one, which was something I've been meaning to tell you from the anthology selected stories, you were suitably impressed.
Yeah. And that's the one that is about Char and...
Yeah, two sisters. Yeah. And the one sister's marriage and their history. It's very... Alice Munro writes, her stories are so subtly layered and complicated, and there's so much going on. They almost are like novels, I think, small, miniature novels, and they're just... I can't, you know, if I did want to write short stories, I would hope that I would write short stories like that.
Well, one of the weird things about her short stories, at least for the at the beginning, is that there's not really a ton of action in them, as far as you or I would consider, within the story frame.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She has a really strong sense of sort of capturing a moment that's pretty insignificant, I guess, in the scheme of things. I mean, I would say that there's some of the one that we're talking about, the very first story, ends with something that I guess would be kind of shocking normally, but is pretty slight, I guess, within the frame of it. But a lot of what she'll do, and actually a better one probably discussed for this is the Labor Day dinner.
Yeah, and I think you can get, I mean, there's not really twists in her stories that I don't think we ruin anything by talking about a character attempting suicide, or, you know, because there's so much there in the getting there that it wouldn't ruin anything for anybody.
That's the thing is that, like, her stuff is not really driven by the plot so much as her slowly...
It's true character-driven writing in the best sense.
Well, and it's also sort of, in some sense, a mystery. A lot of her stories will start out with something where you're sort of thrown in the middle of a scene or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll slowly sort of step back and explore the history of the relationships. And that's something that I think Munro is almost kind of uniquely interested in, is sort of the history of relationships and how relationships sort of build up events over time that sort of color that relationship and sort of increase the tension, or... how grievances are sort of carried forward through time, how relationships can be maintained in despite of difficulties, but how those difficulties are still a factor. Labor Day dinner is another story it's about a Labor Day dinner. And one of the main through lines of the story is sort of chronicling this strained marriage between two of the main characters. And one of the interesting things that Munro actually does in that story, more so than some of her other tales, is that she'll actually click back in the perspective of the different characters. So it'll sort of show why it's strained from the wife's side and why it's strained from the husband's side, which is pretty unusual because for Munro, because Munro actually is predominantly concerned with the female perspective, which leads to some aspects that we'll talk about here in a bit. But she clicks back into the male perspective for this one and sort of tries to explore how this relationship became so strained and... why it's encountering so many difficulties.
I wrote a paper once on Labor Day dinner, as I'm sure you must have figured out by the copious underlining and writing in the margins of this, but it was really interesting that the paper that I wrote was a brief annotation on sort of point of view and perspective, and it's really fascinating what she does in the story, and it seems, because it's third person the whole time, but it's sort of... It's very, it goes from each character's perspective, and not always in a neat way. And she's really I was taken aback by how each scene sort of starts with this, thinking of it as a camera, sort of a wide shot of the characters, and then it slowly gets into one character's head as the scene progresses, and you can see the way she uses the language for the woman, Roberta, when it starts to get into her head, all of a sudden there are a lot more questions in the narrative, like how can you exercise the armpits, what is to be done, and things like that. And when she switches to the male perspective, it's short declarative statements. It starts with George is enjoying the scything, and it, the way she's able to sort of change the language to adapt to each character's head she's in, it's really masterful. And it, she, it gives you the sense that she really has a full grasp of who these people are, and that we're only really sort of getting the tip of the iceberg. I forget who made the famous, I want to say Hemingway, but I'm probably wrong, about how whatever a reader is reading is only the tip of the iceberg, and this huge mass underneath the water is everything that the author knows. And you, the reader may only need to see that tip for the story, but the author has to know what's laying underneath. And I really get that sense from Monroe and from the story in particular, that she knows everything about these people, and she can slip seamlessly in and out of their heads with this narrative, and it's just amazing. And it's something you don't necessarily notice unless you sit down to take it apart like I was forced to do, but it's really worthy of much admiration, I think, her technique in doing that. And I think this is one of her earlier stories.
Yeah, well, it's from her second or third book or so, because I was looking back through that. We pulled selections from two different books, her Selected Stories collection, and then Too Much Happiness, which was her most recent book. And the Selected Stories one is actually pretty light on her early books. It only pulls one story from her first collection, two stories from her second, or something like that. Because I was interested in figuring out chronicling her career, and in just how many stories she's read. The Labor Day Dinner, one of the things that it's sort of highlighted is that she doesn't really imbue her mere characters with as much depth necessarily, because I feel like her male characters are, and Labor Day Dinner being the one exception, is that because she typically doesn't take their perspective, they're typically almost portrayed as almost an outside force or something like that, or like a mechanism in the story itself. And they don't really have the same inner life that it seems like the female characters are always portrayed. But
I do want to say that in this anthology there, I picked the stories that we read because I've read all of the ones in this anthology, and I read Too Much Happiness, and I tried to pick eight that I thought were more interesting, or that I thought were really good examples of the kind of thing that I think of when I think of Alice Munro. There are stories in here that do have, you know, maybe I think I just picked ones. She does write. She does tend to write, I think, from the female point of view. There's only one story in Too Much Happiness that takes place from the male point of a male character. But she does write from the male perspective in some of these other stories. I mean, there are a lot of stories here. The Selected Stories is huge. But so that may be, you know, you've only read...
Maybe your
It may be
taste.
More of my bias than hers, actually. But I would agree with you. I think she does write women particularly well, more so than men. But being a woman writer, I mean, I don't want to sound sexist, because I absolutely do not believe that, you know, women can't write men well. But I'm not surprised that she's writing really complex female characters.
Well, and the thing that she does that she really captures pretty well is sort of the slight violence in relationships, like the ways that men sort of control women, in ways that I guess I don't see a bunch of other authors necessarily capturing so well. I thought she did a good job at that.
And she does too. She writes very well about the Canadian landscape. You know, she's a writer that doesn't stray too. And when we talk about too much happiness, I think she was trying a lot of new things in this book that she didn't always do. But in a lot of her older stories, she doesn't stray too much from the Canadian landscape. You know, she writes very frequently about people in isolated places and around like Ottawa and Toronto and out in the country and people who are living kind of the poor life. She writes a lot about relationships, a lot about families. But yet it seems like even though she's sort of mining the same territory in a lot of her stories, they're still just, each character is so unique that it doesn't really feel like you're reading the same thing over and over again. And one of the stories in the selected stories, the Wilderness Station, it's nice, and you mentioned too it was refreshing to read because it's written kind of in the epistolary form, which is a big departure from the, you know, 30-odd stories that precede it. And I think that was from the collection Open Secrets, which was more recent. But so she's not afraid to take risks, and she does do it. And risks for her, I would say, straying from her usual territory. But at the same time, I think she does, that's a very fascinating story. Do you agree?
Wilderness Station was the one about it was the one taking back in the day.
Yeah, like letters from the boarding school or from the mistress who, and the reverend, I can't remember their names. Yeah, it starts out with a letter, Miss Margaret Cresswell, matron, House of Industry, Toronto, to Mr. Simon Heron, North Huron, January 15th, 1852.
So it's about two brothers who build a log cabin and they send out a wife for him who had grown up at the orphanage. One of the brothers dies and the whole story sort of plays around the different characters' reactions to that and
what happened.
Yeah, and what happened.
What actually happened when he died.
That kind of thing. That one's really interesting because it is told in the epistolary style. But it also gets into sort of another theme that I think is really strong in Munro. One of the themes that is because she sort of writes about rural Canada, it's sort of, I guess for me, an American reader, it reads almost like it's very similar to rural America, but it's sort of with the sense of place sort of stripped out of it, so it becomes in a sense more universal experience of rural living. Because it doesn't have the usual reference as far as you know, to being in the Midwest or being in the South or whatever.
Yeah, and that's what it's, you usually think of.
And it's sort of, it has a sort of same, I guess the analogy I would make would be, there's this book called, Let's Talk About Love, by Carl Wilson, about Celine Dion's music. And he talks about how Celine Dion, is from Canada and, she's, from Quebec, and, Quebec is sort of the experience of being a minority within a country, and a minority culture within a country, is sort of rings true to a bunch of other people, like African Americans and other minorities around the world. And one of Carl Wilson's tasks is trying to figure out why Celine Dion is so popular internationally. And one of the theses he comes up with is that she talks about the Quebecois' experience of being a minority within the country, and that's something that rings true. But is typically seen through the African-American frame in the United States. And so sort of by taking away that those sort of genre standbys, she universalizes it a bit more than you would see otherwise. I'm not really doing credit to the book because it's a wonderful little book. Like, he hates Celine Dion and he tries to get himself to like Celine Dion. So he interviews Celine Dion fans and he goes through her music and eventually goes to a concert, and it's really fantastic. And it's a look at like what taste is composed out of and that kind of thing. But we're going far afield of it. It's a fantastic book. You should check it out. It's a really nice little slim book that's really tightly written and brilliant. But yeah, that was the analogy that came to mind as far as her role, I think. But to eventually skip back to the point is that the role of violence in Monroe is pretty interesting as well. She seems to have much more of a capacity for violence, which than you usually see in authors, which I think sort of gets her out of the sort of the rut that a lot of short story authors for me get into, is that they're talking about stuff that is consequential. Whereas Monroe, I mean, they're books that aren't really concerned about plot, but at the same time, violence and sort of the threat of violence is sort of just around the corner in a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, although sometimes it does happen as a surprise. And it's a very interesting, it's a different approach than Cormac McCarthy's, who is another author who has violence, is very prominent in works, because Cormac McCarthy is sort of portrays violence as an endemic to the world, and but also something that is sort of an output of original sin or whatever have you. It's an output of a fallen world, and so it's mm-hmm. it's inescapable in a certain sense. Whereas Monroe's approach to it is more like there can be people who are otherwise normal and will have a one-time sort of, who have a capacity for violence, but they're not violent people.
Yeah.
In the sense that
that's
we would understand it. And that, in fact, sort of underpins at least one of her, well, I guess I would say multiple of her stories
yes.
are underpinned in realizing that characters who have been mild-mannered throughout most of the story actually killed people. Discovering that and sort of coming to terms with that. And that's something that Monroe does that's pretty unique amongst, I think, pretty much any other author that I've read.
That's a good observation. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but now that I'm thinking about it, you're absolutely right. There is a lot of violence or the threat of violence in much of her work, and in some of these stories in particular, or even I'm thinking of the story Fitz from Selected Stories, which was about the couple that committed suicide. And but really it's about the couple, a woman finds that her neighbors have committed suicide, mm-hmm. and it's really about the couple that find this other couple,
yeah.
and particularly the marriage between the woman who found the bodies and her husband.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, I mean, the violence in that plays a huge role as well. And
yeah.
especially Monroe has too, I wouldn't say there are plot twists, because what she writes is, as you said, not really dependent on plot at all. It's,
yeah.
it's very, character driven, but there are things that you occasionally learn about characters that function as a plot twist towards
yeah.
the end that you kind of realize.
Well, and it's like, it's sort of, she tells you what happened and then she goes back and layers the meaning on top of that.
Yes.
That's how I would say her writing predominantly functions. It's very flashback heavy, very mm-hmm. little of it. And in fact, the epistolary story is one of the few that's actually told in a chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because the narrators are not the most reliable.
Mm-hmm.
So you can play around with that some. And that was how she sort of...
I always thought it was interesting when I was studying her for writing workshops and stuff, that we're always told in stories, you know, there should never be exposition. You should never, you know, tell it, not show it, not tell it, and all that stuff. And a lot of her stories but it's very compelling to read, I'd
yeah.
say.
And it's not so much exposition as it is just slipping little scenes in here and there.
Yeah, and but I mean, she usually will tell you, you know, you start a story and she's talking about the character's childhood or how they met and their marriage. And it's not always scenic. I mean, it is
yeah.
it is very narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thick, I mean, just looking at the pages, they're thick blocks of text and paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of dialogue in
no.
her work. And it is very, very dense
mm-hmm.
in a good way.
Yeah.
But, you know, she really, I don't think she's like, I can't think of other authors that I can compare to her that I would say are very similar to her, because I think she is very unique.
Mm-hmm. I would say the closest is probably Edward P. Jones, The Known World.
Maybe, but
he's sort of on his own little axis.
He is, again. I would say he seems to be an anomaly among writers.
Yeah.
In the way, if nothing else, in the way that he writes, which is apparently in his head. And he doesn't write anything down until it's all in there.
Yeah. He basically wrote The Known World in his head, and then he got laid off one time, and he was like, okay, and then he typed the book up in 6 weeks, and
nobody does that.
Yeah.
And nobody just writes short stories and becomes a famous author for them. Maybe Raymond Carver, but Monroe is as enduring, I think, and I think, at least among writers, she is someone that you come back. I mean, there was a panel on her this week at AWP talking about the art of Alice Monroe, and just a group of people. I didn't go to it because I was going to another one, but I mean, it was just a group of people talking about how awesome her stories are. And, you know,
well, she's probably one of the few authors in the English speaking world that's a legit contender for like Nobel Prize for literature. I could see her winning a Nobel Prize.
I think we can move now to Too Much Happiness, which is, her most recent collection, and I was really struck by how much darker a lot of these stories were than, and again, I probably have more perspective than you, having read all of the selected stories in here, and all of the stories in this book as well, but it's amazing. She's pretty old now. I don't know exactly. I don't remember if she's in her, I think she's in her 70s, and it seems like she's pushing her own boundaries with this book, and I really felt like that with some of the places that she went. And I mean, we didn't read it to discuss it, but she finishes it with kind of a novella about a female mathematician in the last century, and it's really sort of unprecedented for her. It's the topic and the setting and the place and the people. It seemed to me like she's trying new things, and she's continually evolving as a writer, even as she's still using the form that she's most comfortable with. And I thought this was a fantastic collection. Okay, well, there's Dimensions, which is about the woman whose husband is in prison for murdering their children.
That one was okay, I guess.
I mean, that's the first story in this collection, and reading that, I remember when I first started reading it, I thought, Monroe's really, you know, she's got the spade out, and she's really digging here. It seems like, you know, everything in her earlier stories, it's deeper, even deeper now.
Yeah,
places that she's going. I mean, she's dealt with murder before, but this was specifically about what's happening to this woman who's trying to come to terms with the fact that her husband did that. And the second story was Windlock Edge, which was a story about the college student whose roommate is in an unusual situation, and she gets invited to dinner.
As an unusual patron.
An unusual patron, yes, that's a good way of putting it. And gets invited to dinner and discovers that she's required to dine naked. And in the most sort of demeaning part of it is that the man is fully dressed the whole time, and even if he's not taking advantage of her, the fact that she's sitting there naked and they're just having a normal dinner and talking about philosophy and things like that is very jarring and uncomfortable and unusual. And
see, that one wasn't, I didn't like that one as much. It seemed a bit too on the nose, I guess.
What do you mean by on the nose?
It's like literalizing the metaphor type, in the sense. Same sense as, like, I would find a Buffy episode to be pretty pretty not good.
Well, okay.
It's a little bit too, like, okay, yes, men treat women poorly. Thank you for, yes, I'm with you there, Mom.
But the consequence of that being that this woman treats this other woman poorly, having been mistreated by this man.
Yeah.
She resents her roommate for putting her in that position.
Yeah.
And winds up ratting out the roommate. It's more than just men treat women badly. It's men treat women badly, and sometimes as a result of men treating women badly, women treat each other badly.
But that's not universal. I think that's plot specific, though. I don't think that's
universal. Well, it is plot specific, but it's not, I mean, I can extract more from that than just the plot.
I couldn't. Sorry. I mean, it's very like that story, I think, also is being a little obtusely weird to me, and sort of trying hard to be weird instead of having the weirdness sort of organically. No, come
and
out of
you,
it.
But the more I think about, you know, they're both both of the women are sort of powerless, and it's. I mean, I still think there's more here than your average short story, even if it is weird and deliberately weird.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Fine.
I don't think there is, but.
Well, the third story was Free Radicals, which is about a woman with cancer who she's in her home and I guess you'd call him an intruder. Breaks in. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And she winds up having a conversation with him and sort of saving her life by.
Yeah, by fake confessing the secret to him, and so he thinks that he has leverage on her. And then it's a fake secret. So.
But it's a fake secret based on something she did.
Based on something
consider.
That had sort of happened. Yeah.
Yeah, and using the dark, like the most. Unpleasant part of herself to sort of save herself.
Yeah.
But she can't be saved at all because she's dying. And again, I think there's a lot going on in these stories. Like, it's hard to describe them, really, because as we've said, there's not so much a plot as it is
it's
an
more
experience
like, yeah.
in each person's life.
It's more just learning how that how that particular narrator's life is being awful to her. Pretty much. Monroe is kind of like, something happened. My life sucks because of this. Now you know.
Well, there is a story in here, and I should have had you read it, but I was worried that it would turn you off. There's a story in this collection. I think it's called Readership. Let me make sure that's what it's called. No, it's called Fiction. My apologies. Anyway, and it's about a woman who's in a very happy marriage, and then her marriage falls apart because her husband leaves her for a younger woman, and this younger woman has a little girl. And the wife goes through a very difficult time following this, and it ends, you know, some years later when she sort of made peace with it, and the daughter, the little girl, has written a book. And in this book, she's talking about taking music lessons with the wife. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of about the power of writing, and I thought that would get a little too masturbatory for you, so yeah. I didn't recommend it to you, but I mean, maybe there is a little bit of literalism too in here, as you were saying, but I like it. You know, and the last story was Child's Play, which I think, again, applies to the violence and the unsuspected violence.
Yeah.
In this case, the violence of children.
Uh-huh.
And,
No, it's okay, I guess. I think I was more impressed by the selected stories ones.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did read through Too Much Happiness, the four stories you gave me, within the course of a single evening, so I can't say too many bad things about them, I guess. But,
But you would put her up there with... would you classify her? I mean, as in your Greg Brown rating system, how does Alice Munro fall?
Well, she's okay, I guess. I guess my concern, and well, this dovetails on the thing that we were going to talk about, is that she's not really an ideological writer. Like, she doesn't have really an axe to grind.
No, I would agree with that.
And you attended a panel about authors that have sort of an overarching theory to their works and sort of talking about.
I did. The panel was titled Ambitious Fiction. And it was a panel of novelists who've written big novels, either in length or in richness of character or the subject that they're tackling or lush language, you know, sort of all of those things. And I found it really interesting because a lot of what they were talking about was how in today's sort of literary scene, the constant that you hear is always writers praising other writers for their economy and for using very meticulous, spare, precise language. And all of these writers were sort of saying, well, that's great sometimes, but a lot of times it's better to be fully fleshed out than to be ghostly. One writer, Lucy Jane Bledsoe, said that she was so much more forgiving of writers who tried to be ambitious and failed than she was of a writer that just wrote, you know, these perfect little gems of a story and where nothing really happens. And that uneven and sprawling is better praise than meticulous and precise. And I agree with that in the sense that when I think of all the novels that I really love, a lot of them are flawed or a lot of them are extremely ambitious. And but I don't know, I don't think of Monroe as...
Is it because she's short stories?
No, it's not that she's short stories, but her short stories to me are like novels in their density and in their care. I mean, her short stories are so different from most short stories that you read, and I think it's because they are fully... I mean, every character in her stories feels so developed and so real, and mm-hmm. I think that's very hard to do in short stories, and you can sort of get away with it because, you know, a lot of times in a short story, it is more plot-driven,
mm-hmm.
you know? I don't know. I mean... When I think of Alice Munro, I don't think of her as a short story writer. I just think of her as almost as a novelist in the terms of what she does with her characters. But
mm-hmm.
but obviously she's different from someone like Tolstoy or Cormac McCarthy. And that was another thing. You know, they were bringing up these writers. We praise economy and spare language, but a lot of our most celebrated American authors, you know, like David Foster Wallace, Cormac McCarthy, William Faulkner, Toni Morrison, do not write that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you certainly can't call Cormac McCarthy economical.
No.
And that was, in his language. And
B.R. Myers wrote a Reader's Manifesto or whatever, where he basically excoriated every author that was not economical with their words, amongst them Cormac McCarthy. And that was a big kerfuffle back in 2002, 2004, somewhere there. And I would say that, and we were talking about this, sort of like one of the reasons why you get a big push towards economy over sort of fully fleshed stuff is that it's a lot easier to evaluate writing that's trying to be economical on face. Mm-hmm. In terms of whether it's achieved that goal. And that's why a lot of the times you get out of writing workshops and MFA programs, you get a lot
It's accused of sounding the same, and everyone worships at the Church of Raymond Carver. And
mm-hmm.
and it's easier, too. It's easier to write
with that goal
in mind than it is. It's much more... I think it's much riskier to try to write big and
you can't, like, revise your way to like, with writing that's economical, you can revise it and cut it down and make a lot of editing passes and shape it a lot more than you necessarily could a novel that's big and unwieldy.
Yeah, and it was discussed, you know, this was a panel that had Jane Smiley on it, and she was talking about how in these big, complex novels, it's the author starting with a theory about social justice or humanity, you know, some big theory about life and in whatever corner of it this author chooses to investigate, but the best novels are written so well that the theory dissipates into the prose, and it's that the reader won't necessarily draw your conclusions from the book, but it is there.
Mm-hmm.
But that character and story and whatever language, whatever it is, will sort of carry that theory into a huge, full-fledged, populated book.
Mm-hmm.
They don't all have to have that complexity, but that all of the great novels do. And she was using as an example of a novel that did try to prove a theory, but that did not have the artistic complexity as Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, which I've actually read.
I have too.
And which, you know, you can read up to a point, but when you get to the point, and it was the same thing in The Fountainhead, I think. I liked The Fountainhead, but when they start making their speeches at the end, you know, the big John Galt speech, I mean, you just flip through that. you can't do it. And they're not real people.
No. Well, I mean, there's a lot of other problems with the book, but
right. But at its core, I mean, if you're looking at it as purely a work of art, it's very obvious that it's in service of a theory, but it's so in service of that theory that it hardly qualifies as a book.
Well, and it's not. It's sort of the problem with that one, and I think the thing that novels that are concerned with the grand theory do well at is that they actually incorporate that into sort of the syntax of how the novel functions. Whereas that one's very, it's incorporated in on surface level, and you're basically sort of fan fictioned your way into sort of believing it, but it's not really necessarily how the novel functions. Whereas someone like Cormac McCarthy will actually have, like, he doesn't really so much come out and say, you know, his themes about an absent or malicious God, but events sort of happen in such a way that it definitely comes across.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the sense that Cormac McCarthy himself is that absent or malicious God in writing the books. So I guess, what would you say that Monroe sort of is trying to say with these novels? Or these short stories?
Well, I think maybe I'm in agreement with you that she doesn't have an axe to grind in that sense. But I think she's someone who is blessed with a unique ability to the ability and the curiosity to know why people do the things they do, and the ability to really dig into that question. And, you know, for her, it's almost as if there's not a judgment. She's not judging any of these things, and she's not really asking you to judge either.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because, you know, the story about the two children who, and I'm going to give it away, so if you don't want to know.
Well, I think we've implied pretty much that if nobody has died by the end of the story, somebody's probably going to die at the end of the story.
Yeah, in the story Child's Play, you know, these two children who are not evil, I don't think you could say that, but they're
a little Lord of the Flies.
A little Lord of the Flies, but it's not black and white, you know, it's not cut and dry. I mean, they're not the judge in Blood Meridian. They wind up drowning a little girl at their camp that they don't like, and they do so in a way that...
Well, she's not even like a little girl that they don't like. She's like... Someone who lived in the same house as her and is mentally deficient, and in a way that sort of annoying.
Unsettles them. And
when this is what
I'm getting at, though.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah, it is.
And you don't necessarily leave that story feeling, and they do regret. I mean, they get old, and part of the story takes place in the present time, and it's one of the women is dying, and she's wanting. And they never spoke about what they did. It sort of just happened. And if you read the story, it gets more plausible. The way I'm saying it doesn't probably makes it sound ridiculous. But, you know, and they do feel, as adults, genuine horror and remorse at what they've done.
Yeah.
And you don't walk away from that story feeling like, you know, it's a fable. Because none of these are fables, but they are pictures of the complexity of people and the choices they make and the myriad influences and events and decisions. I mean, it's very complicated, and that in itself might be a statement or a theory, because I never really feel like Monroe is trying to get us to judge. I mean, in another,
no,
you
she's,
know,
they're not like little parables
in dimensions. You know, there's the wife winds up sort of, I'm not going to say she goes back to her husband, the murderer, but she finds a peace with him that she can't find with anybody else. And
she finds a peace from him, I would say. Not necessarily with, but His statements, I guess, give her his words give her peace in a way that nobody else's have been able to.
And on the surface, that would be something that you wouldn't necessarily fathom. And I think Monroe sort of likes unfathomable places, and mm-hmm. she likes to go there and see what they look like. And that, I think, you know, maybe you don't have to have an overarching theory, but when you read enough of her stories, you come away with a little bit of a wider idea of what people are like or what can happen.
Well, then you definitely get the sense that these are all works by the same author.
Yeah. And maybe in that some way that's ambitious. I wouldn't call her stories, well, and they're simple maybe in some ways, but I don't know. That's the thing about, it's very hard to pin her down. That's one of the things I really love about Alice Munro. I don't read very many short stories. And this is just like sacrilege to say when you're a writing student, but I don't usually enjoy them, but I do enjoy Alice Munro. So, there. I think we've...
I do too. I enjoy.
Oh my Alice God, Munro. Really? Oh,
I know, I'm liking an author.
We've read an author that...
I don't think I enjoy her as much as you, but I'm glad to have read her.
Good, I'm
She's
glad.
She's pretty cool.
We'll have to figure out what we're reading next. God knows we have no shortage of books in this house now.
Oh my God. I realized today that I read about 50... I haven't actually read 50 books a year, but I'm pretty good pace. I'm about a book a week this
year. Yeah, you're doing very well.
This year. But we have several years worth of books for me to read.
Yeah.
Going at that pace. And that's probably a bit of an exaggeration because a lot of those books are bigger than the ones that I've been reading.
Well, we should read something nonfiction next so you can pick it.
Oh, God. I want to say River of Shadows, but I don't know. We'll try it.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Yeah. I'm sorry we don't have any beer.
What else have you been reading?
I just finished Wasted by Maria Hornbecker. She was another writer that I heard speak while I was at the AWP conference. And I had heard about her book before, and she actually read her poetry at the panel, and I was blown away by it. So I found this memoir, and I've read it in 48 hours, and it was absolutely sort of... brilliant and horrifying. And having finished that, I'm slowly reading Light in August. It's my first go at Faulkner, and I'm trying to read it slowly, kind of like I did Sutri.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's not nearly as weird as Sutri.
Well,
in the beginning it may get there.
I don't think
but,
anyone will be.
But that's very enjoyable, but I'm reading that in chunks. And then my light sort of Starbucks reading, I think I just started The Marrowbone Marble Company by Glenn Taylor, who's on the faculty of the MFA program I was accepted to. So I'm looking forward to...
Yeah, I think that happened since our last podcast.
Deep into that.
You got into MFA, she got into the West Virginia MFA program.
Yes.
So there's a good chance that we will be in West Virginia this fall.
We'll see.
Yeah, but... that's cool. And you've read some other books, too, since then. You're sort of selling yourself short in the
last
2 weeks. I have,
but I can't... off the top of my head, I'm... I read the Best American Essay Collection and the Best American Travel Writing Collection for 2011, which I got in the Kindle. And before that, I read Aaron Tocknell's Confederate Streets, which is another essay collection. I've been reading a lot of essays recently. So...
cool.
Yeah. What about you?
I read Feminism is for Everybody by Bell Hooks. It's a pretty rare little book, really kind of tiny, about 120 pages or so, just talking about feminism and the different aspects of it. And she does a really neat job of sort of recontextualizing feminism within the sense of radical feminism, a strand that's sort of, now hasn't really died out, but it's definitely been supplanted by equality feminism. But she makes a really great argument for it, a really interesting argument for it, and sort of sketches out the different implications of it in terms of race, gender, class, a bunch of other topics that you don't necessarily see feminism discussed in the context of. And in doing so, sort of paints a really interesting portrait of the movement and how it's sort of evolved since the 1960s and... why it's not as prominent in modern discourse as it should be, but it's all very very well written, very informed writing, but very non-academic, which is one of her central critiques, is that a lot of writing about feminism is pretty academic and sort of ends up shutting off feminism to 95% of the U.S. When it should be available to everyone. So it's a real neat little book. If you're going to read one book about feminism, read that. But I'd also recommend, probably in conjunction with something like The Terror Dream by Susan Faludi, which sort of examines a specific event within a feminist lens. In the case of The Terror Dream, it's about discourse after 9/11 and how it sort of reasserted the traditional role of women, and sort of trying to put them back into that box and sort of reassure the traditional role of males, especially in terms of protector and that kind of thing. And she sort of contextualizes it within a larger sort of history of terror narratives and that kind of thing. And it's a weird book too, because it's written like the second half was written first and then the first half. Like she wrote the book about the history of these narratives and then wrote about how September 11th sort of was another example of it. But the editors sort of, I feel like the editors shifted it around. So the September 11th stuff is at the beginning, whereas it should be. Like, if you're going to read the book, read part two first and then go back and read part one, is my advice. But yeah, that's another great book, but I read that one a while back. And then the other book that I just finished is River of Shadows, and I'm going to make an argument for this being our next book, so
okay.
I won't say too much on it, but it's about Edward Muybridge.
You've mentioned
it a few times.
Like every podcast I think we've done so far, you've mentioned River of Shadows. So.
Which is why I had to pick it up and reread it.
It's a very important book to Greg.
It is. It's a very important book to me. So those are my reading, and I read the Alice Munro short stories, and I'm reading N+1 right now.
Which we picked up at the book fair.
Hooray.
Along yeah, it's with a pretty an cool N+1 magazine. Tote bag and tons of other stuff. So
yeah. Books.
Beer, except not tonight. Next time there will be beer.
Yeah. So awesome. Well, if you have any questions or anything, just let us know via the usual channels. Greg Brown on Twitter or Cloissa Hart on Twitter.
Yes.
You can add us or DM us or whatever.
Clarissa liked the show, H-A-R-T.
Yeah, so, yeah. Thanks. Bye.